My Classic Album with Mike Norris is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of My Classic Album and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.
It's just like a wall of awesomeness coming at you. That's how I would describe the whole album.
It's just been a lot of fun for me, Mike, to talk with you about this album at this moment.
It's something that everybody should hear at least once in their life.
It's fucking amazing!
You're listening to My Classic Album with Mike Norris.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of My Classic Album. As always, looking back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris, thank you very much for joining me for another episode of the show. Really excited for this one because we're actually going to be covering one of my favourite albums of my lifetime, certainly. We're going to be looking at Linkin Park's debut album from 2000, Hybrid Theory. I feel it's quite significant. I always think it's quite significant, actually, when we cover these episodes that are from this millennium. You know, a lot of the albums that we do predominantly from the 70s and the 80s, 50, 40 years on, still having that impact. We're starting to cover more albums from the 90s. You know, we do have some coming up over the coming weeks and months on My Classic Album. But albums from 2000 onwards have been pretty rare so far on the show. If I think about it, I think this might be maybe only our fourth album from 2000 onwards. So way, way back in season one, we did Arctic Monkeys' debut, Whatever People Say I Am, That's What I'm Not. We've looked at Blink 182's self-titled album, which I believe is from around 2004, 2005. And most recently, earlier this year, we were joined by The Warning, who chose The Black Parade by My Chemical Romance. So these albums are just kind of coming into that significance, coming into their own, you know, obviously huge hits at the time, really successful at the time. But maybe it is now that we've got about, you know, 15, 20 years of these albums being around that we're starting to recognize them as classic albums in the same way that we would a Deja Vu, like we did last time, for example, or any of the classic albums that we do here on the show. Hybrid Theory, special significance for me and special significance for my guest, Brian Kuznets, who's going to be joining me in just a little bit to talk about the album. I always say about my love of classic rock, of bands like Queen and David Bowie and Elton John and all of this kind of stuff. But for me, a lot of my education of the heavier side of music came from bands like Linkin Park, you know, the new metal scene as it was coming through at the time that I really got into. And that helped me discover a lot of older metal bands and move into other genres of music that I like. So Hybrid Theory, a bit of a gateway album for me, a really important one. So I'm pleased, so happy that we're finally doing it here on My Classic Album today. And as I said, it'll be Brian Kuznets, lead singer of Fame on Fire, who's chosen the album. And we're going to get into that discussion very shortly indeed. But there are a couple of great episodes coming up as well throughout the summer here on My Classic Album. Some that I can't tell you about just yet. Talking about classic albums from the 2000s. And I haven't pinned this one down yet. You know, I always like to announce these after I've actually completed the interview. But it looks like another classic album, another really important one of my formative years as it happens, we will be discussing on the show. Really excited to get this guest on. Really excited to talk about this album. That's all I can say at the moment. So sorry for the kind of the crypticness of that. But we do have a couple of great episodes announced that I'm excited to get stuck into. So in a couple of weeks' time, we're finally going to be doing a Motorhead album. Huge Motorhead fan. Anyone who knows me will know that Lemmy is just an absolute hero of mine. I was lucky enough to see Motorhead a few times before Lemmy's passing. And you'd think we'd be looking at something like Bomber or Ace of Spades or something like that. But Tim Atkinson from Leader of Down, check out Leader of Down if you're a Motorhead fan. It was actually started by Wurzel, and obviously the guys have carried it on after Wurzel's passing. But Tim Atkinson from Leader of Down has actually chosen Orgasmatron, which was Wurzel's first album with Motorhead, but such an underrated album. So not only was I pleased we were doing Motorhead, but I was pleased we were doing something a bit underrated in their back catalogue too. So that's coming up in a couple of weeks' time. And he's got some great stories about his own interactions with Lemmy, as well as, you know, the story of this album. So, you know, really great episode, and I'm looking forward to y'all hearing it. Fast forward to August, and I'll be joined by Terry DeWitt from Deepfall, fantastic band coming out of the US. And Terry has chosen one of the darkest albums probably that we've ever done on My Classic Album, but one that absolutely deserves its place amongst our collection of classics, Alice in Chains' second album, Dirt. And, you know, it's an amazing album. Some really dark, heavy themes on it, really dark story behind it too, but a great album. And, you know, we've covered a few grunge albums in the past, but again, maybe grunge is a genre that we've neglected a little bit on My Classic Album. We've done Soundgarden, we've done a couple of Nirvana albums. So it's nice to kind of move into Alice in Chains. And for me, Alice in Chains are that really nice kind of connection between grunge and metal anyway. They show those metal roots more than anyone. So yeah, that's going to be a great episode too. And as I say, we do have some other ones coming up, but I can't say anything at the moment. But some really exciting potential guests coming on the show, choosing some fantastic albums. So if you want to keep up to date with My Classic Album, you want to know everything that's going on with the show, I feel like every day I'm checking my phone and more people are liking the page and sharing content, which is just really exciting for me. Get yourself to My Classic Album with Mike Norris on Facebook. Make sure you like the page or follow the page. Either works for me, as long as you're keeping up to date with everything that's going on. You can follow us on Instagram at My Classic Album Podcast, or you can follow us on Twitter at MCA_podcast. And of course, all this information, all of our previous episodes, including the Days episode, including our previous episode a couple of weeks ago with Aaron Day from These Wicked Rivers, all of these episodes available at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk. But I've been waiting 6 years for this one. I'm not even kidding. When I started this podcast, I thought someone will pick Hybrid Theory. They've got to pick Hybrid Theory. I can't believe. I mean, to be fair, this is going out July the 1st. That's almost 6 years to the day that I recorded like the first interview for My Classic Album. So I've literally been waiting 6 years for this moment. My very special guest is Brian Kuznets from Fame on Fire. And he has chosen his classic album and quite frankly, one of my classic albums too, Linkin Park. Hybrid Theory. But before we get to my chat with Brian all about this groundbreaking album, let's just have a look at the facts. Here's the beginning of what you need to know about Hybrid Theory. Hybrid Theory is the debut studio album by American rock band Linkin Park, following the union of rap rock band Zero, hosting Mike Shinoda, with vocalist Chester Bennington. The band initially renamed themselves Hybrid Theory before settling on Linkin Park. The band recorded at NRG Recordings in California, with sessions lasting 4 weeks. The album saw its release on October 24, 2000 on Warner Brothers Records. Singles from the album performed strongly, particularly in the UK. Releases charted progressively higher. One Step Closer charted at number 75 on the US Billboard Hot 100 and number 24 on the UK Singles Chart. Crawling also fared well in the UK, reaching number 16, and Papercut continued that momentum with a number 14 placing. However, it was In the End that was the biggest success, reaching number 8 in the UK and an impressive number 2 charting in the US. The success of Hybrid Theory's singles was echoed by the album, which reached number 2 on the Billboard 200 in the US and number 4 in the UK. The album also charted inside the top 5 across the world, including Australia, Canada and Germany. With 12 times platinum certification in America and 6 times platinum in the UK, Hybrid Theory's sales in excess of 30 million worldwide make it the best-selling debut album of the 21st century. As the century has rolled on, Hybrid Theory has been established as a true classic and one of the most influential albums of the 2000s. Rock Sound placed the album 58th in their top 150 albums of our lifetime, while Classic Rock magazine ranked Hybrid Theory 72nd on their 100 greatest rock albums of all time in 2001. So that's just the beginning of everything we need to know about Hybrid Theory, and I have here with me my special guest who chose the album to talk about today on My Classic Album. From Fame on Fire, this is Brian Kuznets. How's it going?
It's going great, man. Excited to talk about this album. It's definitely one of those albums that I think everybody grew up on, and it inspired a lot of the musicians today.
Yeah, absolutely, and it really is such an influential album. I mean, why have you chosen Hybrid Theory to talk about on My Classic Album today?
I chose it because I remember I was like, I don't know, I was really young. I was maybe like first grade or kindergarten, something like that. And I remember I was playing with Crazy Bones at the time. And like my buddy gave me, like my friend who was also like 5 or whatever, his dad had the CD and he gave it to me. And I remember just like listening to it on repeat. And yeah. You know, being like a little kid and listening to like that kind of music didn't really make sense unless you were like really like exposed to it or something like that, because you know, screams seem scary to a kid, right? But yeah. That music just never seemed scary, and it was just good music.
I mean, obviously, like you say, it sounds like if we're talking like first grade, kindergarten kind of time, like again, that is really early exposure to it. Do you have any memories of hearing it for the first time?
I don't know. I remember looking at the I don't have any memories of it, but I remember looking at like the cover art of it.
Yeah.
And like listening to the song with one of my friends, and you know, back in the day, like in the 90s, it was all boy bands and stuff like that. So everybody took part in singing. And so I thought they were just a boy band. So we would like point to them who we thought was singing on the album.
Yeah.
So it'd be like, oh, it's that guy singing right now. Okay, now it's this guy singing, but it was all like just Chester and Mike.
I mean, obviously for you, like you were saying, that was kind of that younger part of your childhood. For me, it was a really important album of my teenage years. So I was about 13, 14 when the album came out. So obviously a really important album of formative years for me at that point. And it played a huge role in my development love of rock and metal, which regular listeners to the show will know has kind of carried on to this day. I know you'd said right at the top there, you know, this is such a defining record, such an important record.
Yeah.
Why do you think, and I mean, obviously, I guess we're coming from two different generations. So why do you think it has resonated kind of so much over the last 22 years as it is now?
I think it's just really good music. I think it was like so, it wasn't just like good songs, but it was so original for the time. Like nobody else sounded like Linkin Park did. Nobody sounded like Chester did. Like nobody was singing like that. I don't know about your generation because you were 13 when it came out. So like, did you guys perceive it as heavy?
Yeah, I definitely did. And I think, okay. I think, like I say, my kind of exposure to rock music at the time was my parents' kind of CD collection. So like classic stuff like Queen and Bowie and all of that. And I think thinking about, obviously we'll talk about the music that was popular at the time, but I think Linkin Park coming through, I certainly felt like it was heavy. It certainly felt like something very different to what had come before.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Like, I think the appeal to like the kids that were my age when we first started hearing it, because I remember it was a thing at my school. Everybody loved Hybrid Theory. Everybody loved like Crawling, and they were like, and I remember this kid came up to me, he's just like one of the cool kids in elementary school, and he's like, so have you checked, do you know Linkin Park? I go, yeah. He goes, Crawling's my song. And I go, okay. But I don't know. I think it's just so musically catchy and musically appealing that everyone wanted to hear it. Everyone wanted to listen to it. Even Chester like screaming wasn't like alarming. It was still musical. And it like, I don't know. It's just a really good album.
I mean, Linkin Park, they were a band, they seemingly came out of nowhere at the time. So we're talking like the turn of the millennium. I guess their story begins in the late 90s. So, you know, we'll talk about this guy a lot, you know, vocalist, guitarist, general musical genius, Mike Shinoda, you know, composing demos in his childhood bedroom. And he told Metal Hammer, I had a 4-track recorder, a guitar that we plugged directly into a tiny little amp and a vocal mic. The whole setup was worth maybe $300. That setup, of course, that would, I think 7 of the 12 songs from Hybrid Theory would kind of be demoed using this setup that Mike had. I mean, how integral is Mike Shinoda, not only to Hybrid Theory, but I guess that evolution that Linkin Park have been on kind of over the last 20 plus years?
I honestly think he's kind of everything. I mean, I don't want to take anything away from Chester because Chester's amazing, but like, I think without Mike, like Linkin Park would have never existed. Like that sound would have never existed, you know? Chester probably would have been doing something like, you know, more like that was, you know, the standard rock of that time. But I think that like Mike introducing Chester to like this world that he was creating of this new sound and new style of rock. I don't know. I really do think majority of it was Mike just getting everything done. I mean, you look at the guy and you can tell the people that are like workhorses and don't stop. And he's one of those people that just doesn't stop. So I think without him, I don't think any of it would have been possible.
I guess a huge piece of that puzzle of kind of the formation of Linkin Park is an A&R executive named Jeff Blue, who he was impressed enough by Mike's demos that he'd done on this $300 setup to sign him and guitarist Brad Delson to a deal under their band at the time, Zero. So Jeff, he talked a little bit to Billboard in 2017, and this is where kind of Chester starts to come into proceedings. So he said in 1999, attorney Scott Harrington suggested Chester from a band called Grey Days in Phoenix as a possible new lead singer to complement Mike Shinoda. We called Chester and asked him if he wanted to make history by being the next big vocalist in a band that no one had heard of yet. Seizing the opportunity, Chester left his own birthday party to lay down vocals to the tracks I'd overnighted him. By the time I got back to Los Angeles from SXSW, I had a demo tape from Chester. What I heard floored me. Every crack of his voice had a story to tell. It was iconic, genuine, vulnerable, urgent, beautiful, and hit you in the gut. And for me, that feels like a crucial moment. And the way you'd put it was really nice. I think that, like, Chester's, obviously he does, he screams throughout this album, but it doesn't, you know, it's not almost in that kind of black metal vein of things. There's a musicality to it. There's emotion to it. What is it that makes, because it is interesting that these kind of two sides were kind of brought together almost by happenstance, you know, yeah. What is it that made Chester the perfect voice for what this world, as you say, that Mike was creating?
I think that it's a couple things. Like he had these screams, but the screams were always a pitch, right? They were always, and it felt like what the key of the song is. There's also just his, you know, voice. It's just, there's something about his voice that is just so, it's so easy to listen to and like want to hear more of. It's like ice cream, you know, you just want more of it. He had everything down. Like his clean singing was, it sounded beautiful. His gritty singing sounded beautiful. His screams were on point always. Yeah, definitely. Like if it wasn't for Mike and Chester together, it would not have, like if it was just Mike doing everything, it wouldn't have been what it is. They needed Chester in order to elevate it to where it went.
And obviously at that point, the band are now kind of formed. Sessions for Hybrid Theory start in earnest. You know, Jeff determined to get this kind of, this union in the studio to see what it can come up with, gets producer Don Gilmore at the helm. NME said during the fast-paced sessions lasting just 4 weeks, Shinoda's rap verses were almost entirely rewritten. Bennington was also persuaded to develop a new, harsher singing style, cementing Linkin Park's distinctive dual vocal attack. Following the departure of previous session players, lead guitarist Brad Delson also played bass on most of the record. So I feel like, with all due respect to the other members of the band, you know, and again, a hugely talented group of people, it really seems like for this first album, it's this trifecta of Chester, Mike, and to an extent Brad, who are like the nucleus of the band's sound and vision at that time, and what we hear on Hybrid Theory.
Yeah, totally. And what was it, Don Gilmore?
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember watching those like videos of like them in the studio. I was like, I was like, hopefully one day I can work with this guy, because this guy's on point. So I just think like, I mean, yeah, it's the trifecta, but also like him as a producer definitely pushed them into the direction of making that album just obviously a masterpiece.
That's a really good point, actually, because we do often talk about kind of the role that the producer plays in like a classic album. And I know that, you know, Don's not, he's not exactly kind of like a Rick Rubin or a Martin Birch, you know, these producers that people kind of wax lyrical about. But it seems that even from watching those videos of them in the studio, you'd seen this kind of innate quality that he had to kind of bring the best out of the band.
Yeah. And like, you know, a good producer will basically take over everything and like call the shots for the band. Like, this is what you guys should do. This is what you shouldn't do. You know, that idea was cool, but this idea is better. So, you know, like, he's just as integral to that album as the rest of the band is.
So, I mean, it's been heavily documented, you know, Chester experienced some really traumatic events kind of throughout his childhood and young adulthood. And he did disclose that he experienced sexual abuse when he was 7 years old, telling Metal Hammer, like most people, I was too afraid to say anything. I didn't want people to think I was gay or that I was lying. It was a horrible experience. His parents then divorced at 11. He turned to alcohol and drugs. We've got another quote from Metal Hammer where he says he was on 11 hits of acid a day. I dropped so much acid, I'm surprised I can still speak. This all kind of culminates to about 1992, when he says that a gang broke into his friend's house where he was using drugs and pistol whipped his friends. Like, I think, I mean, people who kind of listen to the podcast know I work in mental health outside of doing this podcast. And like, if I was speaking to someone who had had that much tragedy in their lives, potentially quite a lot of complex trauma there. And yet, you know, for a long time, he was able to kind of break through that and become very successful. How much of that tragedy do you think informs the vocals that we hear from Chester on Hybrid Theory and across his career? Do you feel that that's kind of innate in his vocal?
I think it's a lot of it. Like, you know, if you've never had anything happen to you in your life, you can't really sing with emotion, I guess I would say. Like, for me, like that's the way I sing. I sing with a lot of emotion because it drives me. So I think it's you know, it's definitely like natural gift from birth, that's for sure. But like, when you throw the emotion on top of that, like that's a recipe for success, 100%. So yeah, going through trauma, yeah, it sucks, but like that's what made him so great.
And I mean, with the help of Jeff Blue, Linkin Park, they were caught on various labels hoping to get a deal. And I know we'll talk a lot as we go track by track about, you know, I think there's a presumption that this is, and I love the genre of nu metal, but this presumption that it's merely a nu metal album, you know, we'll put that in quotations. So obviously, as we'll talk about, there's a lot more going on in this album than metal. Absolutely. But I think I read that it was like 43 labels outright rejected Linkin Park, weren't interested in releasing the album. It took Jeff Blue to get a job with Warner Brothers, where he stipulated in his contract that Linkin Park would be the first band that he would sign. Why do you think it is that the record labels struggled so much with Linkin Park's sound?
Because they were so different, and labels are... Can I curse on this podcast?
Yeah, go for it.
Oh, they're fucking pussies. Labels fear what they don't know. All they want to do is just carbon copy everything. So when you have something that's that different, they don't want to touch it. They don't want to go near it because they're like, this is going to be a bad investment for us. Yeah. Because that's all a label is. They're basically just a bank, and they're investors, right? And so like, this isn't worth our investment because this is too scary and too risky.
And I think if I'm thinking about kind of our conversation so far, a lot of that risk, a lot of that kind of diversity comes from Mike's vision way back in his parents' house when he's in the room kind of cutting these demos. For their part, Warner Brothers, who obviously they end up getting signed with, had made a lot of demands, and they attempted to change that Linkin Park sound drastically, unfathomably, actually trying to oust Mike from the band. And Chester talks a bit about this experience with Metal Hammer. He said, these guys sat me down and were like, oh, you're such an amazing voice. You could be such a shining star. They wanted to see if I would pull a coup to get Mike out. These dudes were so fucking stupid. They told me I'd be the face of the band and that Mike had no story because he was just some kid from Agoura. All these dumb, superficial things. They wanted some rapper from New York who no one knew to come and do vocals on the record. I just wanted to punch those idiots in the face because they couldn't see that golden fucking teat of awesomeness that was right in front of them. And he finishes by saying, Mike's one of the most productive songwriters of our era. And it goes to show, you know, yeah, Chester was new to the band. He was new to this situation. But even at that point, and I felt this kind of from the very beginning, listening to Linkin Park and watching those initial music videos, they just felt very much like a brotherhood. I was very surprised when I learned that Chester had kind of joined the band later.
Yeah, so was I. And I was also surprised when, like, you know, like Linkin Park, like the frontman of Linkin Park is Mike. Like Mike is the frontman. Like, and so I don't know. Yeah, Chester is 100% right. I mean, like, you know, he was in it. They definitely could not do it without Mike. The labels always trying to change things and make things in their vision. They just need to just supply the money and shut up. That's it.
Do you think that's something that maybe for more casual Linkin Park fans or maybe people listening who haven't explored the band very much, do you think that what you've said there about Mike being the front man of the band? Because I agreed with you. I was just like, yeah, he is, absolutely. But do you think for maybe people less known of the band, do you think that's something that might surprise them given with how iconic Chester is and how up front and center he is on a lot of their songs?
Yeah, totally. Like, they're both frontmen. They're both frontmen, but Mike is the leader. Mike is the person of the band. I don't know, because I remember when I found that out, like, when it I don't know if somebody told me or it just occurred to me, but I remember I was just like, oh, shit. I was like, he is the frontman of the band. Like, this is Mike's band. Like, you know, Chester is a part of the band, but this is Mike's band. So, I don't know. I was pretty shocked when I, like, had that realization.
And I think it is, isn't it? Because, again, obviously, like you say, obviously, you're watching MTV or whatever it is, and the video comes on, and Chester's singing. And yes, you're absolutely right. He's a front man, a fantastic front man. But at the same time, you're right. There is this moment where you have this realization of just how much of this band and the image of it and the sound of it comes from Mike Shinoda. And I think if Chester were here today, I think he absolutely wouldn't argue with that at all.
No, I don't think he would at all.
No. So we've touched on this a little bit. That early Linkin Park sound, in particular Hybrid Theory, has always been placed amongst kind of the new metal scene. And, you know, I know some people kind of sort of scorn at that target, that genre. I was a huge fan of new metal at the time. You know, we're talking like bands like Korn, Deftones, Limp Bizkit having massive success. But there was that kind of snobbery by music purists around it at the time. You'd also said, which I thought was really interesting, that when you discovered the album and you were looking at the cover and you were like, oh, I think this guy's singing that, almost like the boy bands of the time, like he's singing this verse and he's singing this verse. There was a bit of an attitude at the time that some people thought that just due to the way that Chester had joined the band kind of through that pairing with Jeff Blue, that the band was somewhat manufactured. So I guess there's kind of two elements to this. So we'll take them one by one. The first thing I'll ask is, like, do you think there's new metal elements to Hybrid Theory, or do you think that's kind of a lazy way to put it? Do you think there's kind of a lot more going on in this album than merely kind of discarding it as a new metal album?
Well, I mean, like, new metal to its basics is basically just hip hop with metal, right? So yeah, I'd say it's new metal. I wouldn't argue that it's not. Like, yeah, it's rock, but like the style that it was in the time is considered new metal. You know, it had 808s, it had synths, it had like DJ scratching. It had all these things from hip hop, and then you throw metal guitars on it, like heavy guitars and heavy drums and Chester screaming, you know, there's your rock element. And then, you know, Mike rapping, there's your rap element. So yeah, together they are new metal. They're like, but it's like as good as new metal can ever get. So, you know, like Korn's a different style of new metal. Korn's a bit weirder, but like, you know, their rock and their element of new metal is purely instrumental, I would argue. And if sometimes definitely flow.
Yeah, I think it's what's interesting for me. And I mean, again, as I've said, I love new metal bands. Obviously, the bands were not like a huge fan of Korn. I was a huge fan of Limp Bizkit back in the day. But I think when we think about Limp Bizkit, they were a band that got a lot of scorn, and they were kind of the leading new metal band at the time before Linkin Park came out and stuff. Do you think that maybe that was something that Linkin Park had to rally against, kind of perhaps, you know, perhaps unfairly, kind of a Limp Bizkit comparison, that sort of thing?
Yeah, Limp Bizkit wasn't musical. That's the difference between Linkin Park and Limp Bizkit. They were heavy. Like, they were, you know, they're in your face heavy. Linkin Park's heaviness was kind of hidden behind the musicality and all the melodies. So yeah, there's a very big difference. And also, like, just their production overall. The production of Linkin Park is far exceeds anything that Limp Bizkit has done.
I guess the other bit, when we're thinking about those kind of accusations of being manufactured and stuff, I mean, what are your thoughts on those? Because I don't feel like just because an A&R executive has brought these people together, I don't think that makes them manufactured.
Yeah, okay. So if someone was going to be manufactured, like if a label manufactures something, people, like, they aren't going to make something like Linkin Park. Mm-hmm. They're going to make something that is popular at the time. They're not going to waste their money. They're not going to waste their time manufacturing this new sound. They're going to just basically take a sound that somebody else has already done and generally make it better, and if not perfect it, you know. Wasn't Paramore manufactured?
I've got to say, Paramore aren't a band I know a lot about, in all honesty, but
I'm pretty sure they were, like, it was very like they were an industry plant.
I might have to look into that. I genuinely don't know. I'll have to have a bit of a look later on.
I mean, if you think about what was at the time, it's like you had a Fall Out Boy that was like going up in the charts, like All American Rejects, like those style bands, like 1982. It's like, well, what's the next step for pop punk? And, you know, but that's a different day.
Yeah. I mean, I found a quote from Mike that sums up the appeal of Linkin Park. And I think there was something you'd said that sort of resonated with me, that, you know, obviously the heaviness of Korn, which is, I think is a more appropriate comparison, is kind of in the music. Whereas I think that a lot of kind of the heaviness in Linkin Park, absolutely, it's a heavy album, but a lot of it's in terms of kind of the emotional heaviness of it, in the same way that Korn, there's an emotional weight to it. And Mike talked about that, the appeal of Linkin Park. And he said, people would ask us, they'd say, well, Jonathan Davis practically grew up in a morgue and was molested and all these horrible things. What gives you the right to be angry? But you don't have to have gone through the worst things in the world to feel sad. And that's absolutely true. And I'm a huge fan of Jonathan Davis. He's a huge musical hero of mine. And that's not to invalidate his experiences and my gosh, the music he's created as a result of that. But that doesn't invalidate the experiences that Chester's had or Mike's had in producing the music that they produced.
No, like, I mean, like, here's the deal, though. Your worst is your worst. Whatever you perceive is the worst, that is the worst. So, you know, everyone's got their own story. And, you know, it's almost rude to, like, discredit someone's story. Someone asked that to Mike Shinoda, that in an interview?
Yeah. I think it was just, they were just talking about kind of the, I guess, kind of the backlash that they'd received from being these accusations of being manufactured, and like, oh, yeah, okay, you know, what have you got to be sad about, kind of thing, which is horrendous.
Wow.
I know.
That's so dumb.
I know. I mean, as I noted earlier, I was a teenager when Hybrid Theory came out, so it was the perfect time for me, as I'd said, for this album to be unleashed. You know, at the turn of the millennium, anyone who was around at the time, particularly maybe my generation that was kind of about to move in adulthood, there was a lot of uncertainty, a lot of angst about the world at large. I've got a quote from Daryl McIntosh at Albinism, and he says, "I mostly remember anxiety during the final weeks of 1999 instead of excitement. Widespread tension arose regarding a major glitch in computer programming and to what extent the ramifications of Y2K would impact our daily routines. Even after our clocks ticked past January the 1st, 2000, there seemed to be a lingering uncertainty about living on the other side of a new millennium." And, you know, we know that Mike wrote a lot of these songs in the late 90s. You know, he maybe wasn't thinking about the millennium when he was writing them. Obviously, Chester will have had kind of other themes when he's been writing too. But in terms of that album connecting with people and resonating with people, do you think it was, how important do you think that air of uncertainty and anxiety was? Do you feel this was an album that was easier to connect with if people were feeling that way?
Yeah, totally. You know, it's funny. Like, I never really thought about that because, like I said, my experience was completely different. I was a happy kid. I didn't care about what, like, some dude on this record was talking about. Like, I just cared about the music. I cared about the melodies. Like, yeah. It was good. It was cool. But, like, yeah, you know, when I got older, of course, I started listening to this. I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, these dudes are not okay. You know? But yeah, I was like, I think that it was massively impactful for anybody that was feeling anxious. I mean, like, I feel like ever since the 2000s, you know, everyone's just always had that like constant anxiety of what the hell kind of world do we live in today, or what's going on with me, or anything. And so I think that album, that's one of the reasons that the album still holds up today. Because if you're all a completely happy utopia, then it, you know, a lot of music would suffer. I think like that album, keeping it real with the lyrics, I think it had a really big impact on people. And it helped them understand that they're not the only ones going through what they're going through right now.
I mean, from battles with their label to failed coups, accusations of being a new metal boy band, Hybrid Theory ultimately became the best-selling debut album since Guns N' Roses' Appetite for Destruction. 27 million copies worldwide from last check, with 12 million of those being in the US alone. Kerrang's Luke Morton went on to say, "It's not hyperbolic to say that Hybrid Theory is one of the most important rock albums of all time." So we're about to go track by track and talk about these songs, but what do you think makes this one of the most important rock albums of all time? Is it everything we've been saying? Is there anything else that we can say that makes it so important?
It was just really revolutionary in music. Like, and also, you know, Chester's singing was revolutionary on how to sing that way, and that you can sing gritty and you can scream and you can get away with these sorts of things and make it sound appealing to people.
So let's dive in. Let's go track by track. And, you know, there's some huge singles on this album. There really is. And obviously we've got one of them here in the UK. This was a huge single with Paper Cut. Yep. So one of their most well-known songs, one of four singles released from Hybrid Theory. Kerrang said the song, "This is where it all started. Track one, side one. The first time that millions of people heard Linkin Park, they were met with a mesh of rapping and downtuned guitars that would define a generation, alongside an infectious anthemic chorus." What are your thoughts on Paper Cut, and how does it kick off the album for you?
You just get hyped when it comes in. I remember like reading something that Chester said a while ago, where he's like, every single time like we play Paper, like someone asked him like, "What's your favorite song to play live?" And he said, "Paper Cut," because every single time it comes in, like, I don't know, I just never get sick of that song. Like, it's sick. Like, it's a great song. And so he's like, "I love performing it." You know, I'd have to agree with him. I think if I was to play that song live, I would get hyped as fuck every single time. It comes in with that beat. Once it hits, you're like, okay, this is sick as hell. And you know, you got just a really catchy chorus, and you really can't beat it.
I mean, Mike told Kerrang, he said the beat was influenced a lot by Timbaland. Then the guitars kick in with a very cutting edge, what you call nu metal now type of sound. Underneath that, there was a drum and bass beat happening at the same time. So within the first 20 seconds, you're getting three major genre touch points jammed together, which I'd never thought of it like that. You know what I mean? Like, for me as a kid, like you say, you listen to it, you just, you know, you like the song, you like how the guitars sound, you like the vocal. It's a cool song to listen to think about just how much is packed into that. Do you think this is a good track to evidence, you know, when people maybe just throw them away as a new metal boy band or something of not much substance? Is Paper Cut a good defense against that?
You know, people can have their opinions. I wouldn't say it's a good defense against it because it's a really good song. And like, yeah. You know, even down to like the guitar riff itself, like that, like everything they do, it's so smart what they do though. Like everything they do in their music is catering towards the song. There's no like, oh, I'm singing this, or the guitar players aren't like, oh, well, I'm going to play this intricate like guitar part, because I think they realize that like that's not what it is anymore. Like people don't care about that. You know, you have the lead and then it comes in. I think they did everything perfectly that like suits the song to its best ability. I mean, if people want to dismiss it and say it's just nu metal, I'm like, yeah, you can say it's just nu metal, but like it's so much more musical than what nu metal is.
Yeah. I mean, it's a popular track within the band themselves. So Mike told Vulture, he said, I've always said that Papercut was the track that defined Hybrid Theory for me. If there was going to be a calling card, that's it. I knew that the other ones were better singles for all the reasons that they worked, but I always felt like Papercut was so much of the band in one song. I guess that's a really interesting way to put it. And another a band that evolved so much kind of over the years. But if we were talking about this kind of era of Linkin Park, is Papercut the best example of kind of what Linkin Park were about?
No, I don't think so.
Is it coming up?
There's two songs that I just think are so cool on the album. I mean, I love every song on the album, but like, there's two songs that like I was like, whoa! Cool. Like I remember when I first heard those songs, I was like, that's my favorite song, and that's my favorite song.
Well, I'm excited to get to those.
I mean, you know what? Maybe he is right though, because Papercut has like this like commercial appeal to it too.
Hmm.
But also, they're like kind of just yelling on the chorus. Like that's like Linkin Park's whole thing is just yell one note throughout the entire chorus, especially on Hybrid Theory.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, maybe he is right, where it's just like it is an element. Like there's elements of every single song just in that one song.
I mean, another advocate for Papercut within the band is Mr. Hahn himself. Joe Hahn told Dig, Papercut at the time was one of my favorites. We were really trying to mash up styles, and I think we did that pretty successfully. The album's called Hybrid Theory because it represents the ideal. So I guess it's more evidence, you know, regardless of you know, because we're all going to have our favorite tracks and our favorite moments of the album, but more evidence that at least for the band, obviously you'd said Chester's love for the song. This is obviously an important track for them on this album.
Yeah, I think they all really love this song. It's one of those songs though, like I feel like I've heard, I don't know, even if I was listening to it today, like I've heard that song so many times. Linkin Park has always lived on some sort of playlist of mine, and Papercut has always been on that. Actually, the entire Hybrid Theory album has always been on a playlist of mine. Yeah, I don't know, it's definitely just it's one of those special songs, and like starting an album out with it is definitely, I think, the best way to go about it.
So we'll move on to my introduction to Linkin Park back in the day. I remember watching the music video very, very vividly. So that's one step closer. And as I said, I was immediately hit by kind of the anger, the power from the song, the kind of the brotherhood of this band. And I felt like I really needed to know who these guys were. One Step Closer is, you know, it probably still is one of my favorite songs of all time. Can you remember your first exposure to One Step Closer? Was that kind of when we were talking earlier on? Did you discover the album all at the same time? Or do you think that maybe there were tracks that you kind of gravitated towards early on?
One Step Closer is definitely one of those songs where as a kid, I didn't like it as much. And the reason being is probably because it was heavier. But like now I listen to One Step Closer and like, yeah, like it slaps. It's just, it's a very aggressive song.
Yeah.
So I don't know, but like listening to it now, like I said, now I'm just like, yes, let's go. But as a kid, it definitely was not one of the songs that I gravitated towards a lot. Was that the one where they were like in a sewer looking place?
Yeah. Or I don't know if it was like a sewer or a subway or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah. It was just green. Everything was green.
And I think it was either Mike or Chester had green hair. I'm going to put money that it was Mike. Had the like spiky green hair and like...
I think Mike had red hair.
Ah, red hair possibly. Yeah. Yeah. But I remember seeing it so vividly and thinking like, who are these guys? Like what is this? And obviously as an angsty teenager, it came at like the perfect time with it being such an angry song.
Yeah. Yeah. Chester's got blonde hair. They both have spiky hair. Chester has blonde hair.
Ah, red hair. Wonder why I thought green. I think there's a lot of green in the video. Like you say, I think
the whole video is green.
Yeah, yeah. That's where I've gone wrong.
Yeah, so I remember seeing that video on. I think it was MTV. I saw it on.
Or yeah, yeah, yeah. So the Stereo Gum reflect on the song's impact around release, and this is kind of from the perspective of the author. So they say, something kept pulling me back to One Step Closer. There was the gleam on the opening guitar riff, the weirdly satisfying use of the old quiet to loud dynamic, the sense of space in the beats, the lead singer's pained and nasal yowl. The song moved. It had some weird gravity working for it. It was the same sort of impotent rage teen angst anthem that every other new metal band was offering, but it was somehow sleeker, smarter, more. You know, obviously you'd said as a kid, you know, this happy-go-lucky kid who was just enjoying the music, you didn't hugely identify with the song at the time.
No, I didn't have the angst. But yeah, like everything you say to me on One Step Closer to the Edge, like, come on.
I mean, beneath that anger, do you think, I mean, to be fair, like I say, nu metal in itself is quite a, apart from, well, not even Limp Bizkit to an extent, it's quite an angry genre, I think. But, you know, do you think that the anger coming from a track like One Step Closer, it was quite unique for the time?
Yeah, totally. I think that, I don't know, I try and think of like other artists that spoke to, you know, the teenage population up to that point. And I feel like no one really did until Linkin Park. Like, I don't know. I can't think of a single band that spoke directly to those people.
I mean, you talked a lot about Don Gilmore earlier on, and NME note that the Fiery One Step Closer was written in direct response to the band's label when Shinoda felt that they had tried to kick him out of the band. He noted in a 2015 interview that the betrayal brought the group closer together, and they penned the song in response, with Bennington's famous "Shut up when I'm talking to you" line being a direct message for the meddling label. So again, I think it's this true encapsulation of this battle that the band had with the label, you know, to be the band they wanted to be, to have Mike be a part of it. You know, it seems like One Step Closer was where a lot of that anger was able to be unleashed.
Yeah, that's really cool. I didn't think about that, but that's really, really cool to know.
Yeah. And to talk about Don, because I did briefly touch on him just there, this is a really good example, and I really want to hope, and I think I'm guessing from the stuff you've watched, it makes me think even more that this was intentional. But this is a great story from the Hybrid Theory Sessions from Chester. So he said, when they were recording One Step Closer, Don was really drilling me and Mike about lyrics, and it had gotten to the point where we'd rewritten some songs 30 times. I remember walking into the control room, handing Don the lyrics, and he grabbed them, passed them in front of his face without even looking, handed them back to me, and told me to do it again. I lost my fucking mind thinking, this guy's a fucking maniac. But that kind of inspired the lyrics. I cannot take this anymore, saying everything I've said before. All these words, they make no sense. It all came from the frustration. So I guess in the end, he inspired me the way that he wanted to. And like we say, surely the sign of a great producer, isn't it?
Yeah, what a fucking genius, man. Yeah, that's sick.
It reminds me of Number of the Beast, where they kept getting Bruce Dickinson to sing that opening verse over and over and over again, and then he just got so exasperated he let out that scream, and that's what we hear on the final record. It's a very similar kind of catharsism, isn't it?
There's also something that Jonathan Davis's producer did. I think he told him to get naked in the booth to
okay.
feel vulnerable and like exposed. I don't know, it was something weird like that, but I was like that's cool.
Speaking of Jonathan Davis, I'm going to have to look into that, because I'd be really interested to know what song that was. But speaking of Jonathan Davis, One Step Closer was one of many songs from Hybrid Theory that were remixed and reimagined for 2002's Reanimation album. And my favorite remix from that is probably the One Step Closer remix, particularly because it has this really cool vocal passage from Jonathan Davis from Korn. And I know he joined them on stage a couple of times, and he kind of sang the passage kind of during their performances of One Step Closer. What did you make of Reanimation as a whole? And what did you think of Jonathan Davis's kind of feature on One Step Closer?
You know, I'm going to be completely honest. Reanimation, never really listened to it. It was one of those albums that as a kid I could not find. Like, it was really hard to find. Like, you could find Hybrid Theory, but no one had, like, every store I went to didn't have Reanimation. And so, like, I never found it. I remember I listened to it, though, when I was, like, on a trip with one of my friends. Like, he had the album on his cassette player on his Sony Walkman, right? He was listening to it, and I started listening to it. And, like, it didn't appeal to me because it was very washy kind of, like, synths and pads and all that sort of stuff. And so for me, I was just like, nah, I'm not gonna listen to this. So honestly, I've never heard the One Step Closer with Jonathan Davis.
And I think I'd be really interested to hear, obviously, I think One Step Closer is a flawless song, but I would love to hear a version where they kind of popped in the Jonathan Davis vocal just to kind of see how it changes it. I think it'd be really interesting.
Yeah, I would love to hear that.
It's crazy to think back to, I mean, what, 2000, I'll have been 13, 14 years old, you know, discovering this band. And as you'd heard me saying, they're discovering them on MTV and all of that stuff and really loving the album. Little would I know what a huge impact this album and indeed Linkin Park would have on music. So my conversation with Brian all about this amazing album is going to continue in just a little bit. I'd love to hear your thoughts, as always, on Hybrid Theory or indeed anything relating to music or classic albums. You know, again, get yourself on the social media pages. Just search for My Classic Album with Mike Norris on whatever social media channels that you use. We should be quite easy to find. And just let me know. Let me know what you think. Or drop me an email. Get to myclassicalbum.co.uk and send me a message. But yeah, for me, a really important album. And I'm really excited that we're finally getting stuck into this one. But you can't argue that Linkin Park's influence on music is still very much there. And Favour on Fire happily wear that influence on their sleeve. Their new album, Welcome to the Chaos, is out later this month on the 22nd of July. Here's one of the tracks from it, a standout for me. This is Fame on Fire with Plastic Heart. When I look into your eyes, I can see a thousand lies. And if I just walked away, would your plastic heart break? Yeah, I guess it's time to face it. I'm unhappy and I hate it. Wish I could take back the past and just fucking erase it. Spending money I don't have, and now you want me hated. Nothing's ever good enough. You make things so complicated. And I swear if I walked out, would you even hesitate? You'd be fucked up in a mansion somewhere out there in LA. Life is easy when you're heartless, I can see it on your face. And with all the drugs you take, I hope they make you go insane. You'd do anything for a taste of fame. You might act different, but you're still the same. And even though I don't let it show,
for satisfaction you hurt yourself, injecting all your imperfections.
Taking needles to your face won't change your ways. You might look different, but you're still the same.
And even though I don't let it show, it's killing me inside. When I look into your eyes,
taste of fame. You might act different, but you're still the same. And oh, I know.
When I look into your eyes, when I look into your eyes, I can see a thousand lies. And if I just walked away, would your plastic heart break? It's always a compromise. I've seen this shit a thousand times.
So let's move on to With You. So as we said, there's some huge songs on this album. Kerrang ranked the album from kind of, I don't want to say worst because I don't think there's a duff track on this album, but from kind of least good to best. And they actually placed With You second in their ranking of the entire album. And they said that With You is by far the most underrated track on Hybrid Theory. And it's a stone cold banger, from its scratching intro to the elongated guitars to the minimalism and electronica that permeates the verses. This track best highlights the duality of vocal styles, but it's Chester's guttural vocal that makes your hair stand on end. Seriously, stick it on now and tell us you don't get goosebumps. You know, do you think With You is an underrated track? You know, would you say, you know, is it kind of top three, second greatest track on the album?
No, I would not say it is. Is it underrated? Yeah, I would say it is. I would say it is underrated because it's a really good track. I mean, that's one of those tracks that I just remember listening to a lot. I wouldn't put it at number two. I'd probably put it somewhere in the middle, like number five, if I had to.
This is an album, like, and it's funny, sometimes we get people on there talking about their favorite album of all time, but they will say, you know, occasionally I'd skip this track, and it's totally fair enough. I don't think there is a track that I skip when I listen to Hybrid Theory.
Nope.
I think it's that strong an album. But with that in mind, do you think that perhaps if this had been more of a patchy album, for lack of a better way of putting it, do you think that With You could have been a strong single, or do you think that it's too experimental for radio airplay?
I think it's the chorus that's like too drawn out.
Mm-hmm.
That makes it too, like, not, it doesn't make it hooky enough for airplay. I think that's what I would say compared to some of the other songs on the album.
So this one was actually a collaboration with the Dust Brothers, and they would obviously, because of that work with them, they were lucky enough to make use of some unused loops from Paul's Boutique by the Beastie Boys. So Joe Hahn told Billboard, they basically gave us a bunch of stems from an unused remix they had, so we constructed that into the song. So we've talked already about how there's far more influences than metal on this album. How much of an influence do you think the likes of Beastie Boys have maybe had on the Linkin Park sound, perhaps particularly Mark or Joe?
Oh, it's probably massive, actually. I never really put two and two together, but like I can see that being a very prominent influence in their like stylistic playing of guitar, even drumming.
Yeah.
Like a lot of hi-hat work, which is cool.
So let's move on to one of the other singles released from Hybrid Theory, certainly here in the UK anyway. So this is Points of Authority. So I think over here it might have been the remix from Reanimation that was released as a single. But nonetheless, it did see release. Kerrang say Mike's smirking motor mouth delivery cements how integral hip hop is to the Linkin Park formula, especially in a song with more hooks than a butcher's fridge. I mean, obviously we've talked a lot about that metal influence. You know, how integral do you believe the hip hop influence is beyond that standard nu metal comparison? Because we've said hip hop's a huge part of nu metal. How did kind of Linkin Park kind of take that and kind of run with it, as it were?
Linkin Park was like, Mike Shinoda's a rapper. Like, he is genuinely hip hop oriented. He is a hip hop producer, if you would call it, right? So like everything he did in the space of hip hop was real. Like, it's all genuine because this is what he does. Points of Authority is like, that's one of those songs on the album where it's like, there was a video for it. There was a, like a 3D animated video, I think like robots walking around or some shit. The video sucked, but but I remember that song coming on the TV and I was like, holy shit. I think that's how I found Linkin Park. I think it was just from like MTV or something like that. But I remember like their songs coming out, and like I remember Points of Authority and I was like, this is the coolest song I've ever heard. Like the intro of it was just so cool. And I was like, I'm hooked. I don't even know what he's talking about. Forfeit the game before somebody else like takes you out of the frame. Like, I'm just like, what does that even mean? But like, it was just so good. And like the effect he had on his voice, it was just, that is one of the ultimate songs on the album, in my opinion.
I guess it's interesting because again, I've often thought with that bit, and it's the coolest part of a very cool song. to put it that way. But I know the blog We Plug Good Music single out Points of Authority, and the author calls it one of my favorite tracks of all time, a track that I feel everyone can relate to in some way during their adolescence. While I've read many interpretations of the song, to me this song felt like my relationship with my parents at the time, a feeling of not being heard and wanting to lash out in any way possible. I mean, obviously you'd said, again, as we've said, you happy-go-lucky discovering these songs on MTV, just thinking that they're awesome. What does the song mean to you? Or is it just that it's absolutely banging and it's just a cool song?
Yeah, I think it's just banging. Like, yeah. I've never listened really to the lyrical scope of it or what they're talking about or singing about in the song. Mm-hmm. I just love the music of the song and like the vocal rhythms and just it's just a really, really good song.
So as we'd said, it did appear on Reanimation, and I think the CGI robot battle, if I remember rightly, I think that was maybe the video for the Reanimation one. But I think there's also, I've seen like a video of them like performing it live that floated around as well. It seems to be a song that's kind of ripe for remixes and covers over the years. So, you know, Crystal Method remixed it. Jay Gordon from Orgy remixed it as well. Do you think that's the hip hop influence of it that makes it a song that's just so ripe for remixing that people kind of go back to it time and time again?
100%, because that was definitely like a really big thing in hip-hop, was remixing other hip-hop artists' tracks. And so, yeah, they did it perfectly. It was perfectly executed.
So we'll move on to one of the songs that resonates the most with me, which is Crawling. So this is a track that NME says reflects on Chester's time addicted to hard drugs, as well as the sexual abuse he suffered as a child, which we touched on earlier. I mean, for me, would you agree this is one of the most powerful moments on the album?
Yeah, you really, it's one of those things where it's like, I've heard Crawling probably a billion times in my lifetime, right? But it's undeniably good. Like, you cannot deny the song's greatness. Are we sick of hearing it? Probably some of us, yeah. But like, I mean, like, I won't skip Crawling, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just, that was the big song from that album. Mm-hmm. I know there's a, we'll get to it, but Crawling is definitely one of those songs that, like, once people got sick of in the end, they were like, this is the song. Mm-hmm. We're going to listen to this for the rest of time.
I mean, Chester told Spin Magazine, he said that Crawling has caused me the most trouble live more than any other song. Crawling is about feeling like I had no control over myself in terms of drugs and alcohol, hence the line, these wounds, they will not heal. And I guess I took that quote in two ways. You know, is it that he's struggling with the song due to having to go back to that place emotionally? Or do you think there is some challenge vocally in kind of nailing that one live, kind of night after night after night?
No, I think it's emotional for him. I think it's 100% emotional. It's a relatively straightforward song to sing. Like, the entire chorus is one note. Yeah, I think it's just an emotional place for him to go back to and every single time he sings it.
I mean, we've talked a lot about those kind of new metal trends at the time. This one feels for me like, when I think about the new metal bands and the metal bands I was enjoying, this Crawling maybe feels a bit kind of the closest to a lot of that in many ways. However, in their original review of Hybrid Theory, so this was kind of when it was released, Rolling Stone noted a new wave vibe on Crawling, saying Mike Shinoda's catchy rhymed refrains bounce off singer Chester Bennington's new wave croon, proving that synth pop can get with the hip hop. And I read that and I was thinking, that doesn't make much sense there. But it was early in the day when I was kind of listening to the album again for the more millionth time. And there was something about kind of the space in the song and kind of the vibe of the song that almost kind of had me in mind of like Depeche Mode or something like that. Do you hear any kind of sort of like synth poppy new wave sort of influence on Crawling?
No, I don't think it's synth pop at all. I think it's like quintessential like new metal style. Like, because if you replace that synth with like, you know, a Korn guitar, like if they played that on guitar with this like tremolo effect, like it would just be straight new metal. Like, there'd be no difference to it. I mean, just because there's a synth in it doesn't make it new wave, because the synth is not poppy by any means. It's a very dark, gritty synth. And so, yeah, new wave, no.
So the reason Crawling resonated with me so much is, so I've always related the lyrics and even the music to the experience of having a panic attack. So about 8 years after the album came out, I started struggling with panic disorder. And I had that for many years throughout my 20s, kind of multiple panic attacks a day on some occasions. And Crawling is one of two songs that I feel most accurately conveys what a panic attack feels like for me. So I'm not even saying that that's what the song's about, or I don't know if Chester ever experienced a panic attack, but for me, it's the musical equivalent of that. Like, I get that sense of understanding, relatability, I guess. You know, do you think this is a track that those who struggle with their mental health might gravitate towards for kind of similar reasons?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, the way I relate Crawling is almost at a dark side of your brain, I would say. You know, if I was Dexter, I'd say Dark Passenger. But like, you know, like, these negative thoughts that you think throughout the day, they basically consume you.
Yeah.
And so that's the way I relate the song.
And I guess, because I know that someone will ask me at some point, when I've said it's one of two songs, I know someone will ask me what the other song was, and it's Fallen Away From Me by Korn. So another Jonathan Davis reference in there. I think we're on about four or five now. Yeah. but no, I think that's another song that really kind of accurately explains that experience for me anyway. So I don't know that for what that's worth.
I would agree.
We'll move on to Runaway. So this is one of the oldest songs on Hybrid Theory, written during the band's time as Zero. And this is one that actually has a writing credit for their original lead singer, Mark Wakefield. I mean, what do you make of Runaway? Like, do you feel it stands out compared to songs that were maybe written kind of closer to the time?
Nah, it's one of the duller ones on the album. Like, it's, yeah. I don't think it's like it's not bad by any means, but like no. it is compared to the scope of the album itself, it's definitely one of those like duller songs, and it could be one of those songs where like, okay, well, we need a, you know, a 10th song or whatever on the album. We got Running Away. Let's throw that in there.
I mean, Pitchfork say skyscraping hooks on songs like Runaway were a byproduct of confrontational producer Don Gilmore, who told the group plainly that their cluttered primitive tunes would be also rans if they didn't cough up some melodies for alternative radio. I mean, does it feel, I know you were saying it feels like it's like, oh, well, we've got 10 tracks, let's put this on. Is there an element of maybe like, oh, this might be good for radio. Like if the rest of it doesn't succeed, like let's put this one on.
Yeah. I would say like it feels like one of those choruses that they like wrote with intent, but also like kind of separating from their like what they really wanted to do. So it's not genuine feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's like the overall issue with Runaway.
I mean, obviously when the album was released, it wasn't sequenced with vinyl in mind. So I mean, I've got my original CD hold away somewhere, but like the copy I tend to play the most is my copy on vinyl, and Runaway closes side one of the album. So if we're thinking of it from that perspective, that maybe that's not what was going through their mind when they were sequencing it, does it feel like a good way to close the first half of the album? Do you think maybe if they were releasing the album today, and obviously vinyls had this resurgence, do you think that maybe it would have played out differently? Do you think maybe another song might have closed side one?
Yeah, maybe like maybe swap Points of Authority around.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I would close with that, and then I would close like the other side with In the End.
And I think that's interesting because as we move into By Myself, obviously, so that's, again, if we're flipping the record over or the cassette or whatever, you know, that doesn't feel like a side two opener either, with no disrespect to the song. You know, again, it's almost these kind of sort of songs in the middle of the album that if this were a different format, they wouldn't necessarily be kind of bookending sides of an album, I would say.
Yeah, you know, that's one of those songs where it's like, it doesn't, like, I don't hate it. I don't love it. It's one of the few meh songs of the album for me. Just throw it in the middle somewhere. You know, if Don Gilmore was really pushing for it, then cool. Let's keep it on there, keep him happy, you know? Because politics does play a hand in these things sometimes.
And I mean, what are your thoughts on By Myself? So again, obviously, we're in this kind of middle point of the album, or we've flipped it over or whatever we've done. Is Myself kind of a lift up from Runaway, or are we still in that kind of...
Definitely, definitely. It's definitely a better song than Runaway.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, Runaway might be my least favorite song on the album.
Yeah. So what is it about By Myself that kind of lifts proceedings?
It's more genuine to Linkin Park. I think that's what it is. It's more genuine to them and how I perceive they want it to sound. Nothing feels forced on it or anything like that. Like it's just another really, really good Linkin Park song.
I mean, We Plug Good Music say that the song really displays Mike's lyrical ability when describing self-destruction and self-doubt. You know, obviously you've said it feels a bit closer to their identity and what they were about. You know, do you think this is a strong track lyrically for the album?
I don't know. I By Myself, I've never really like sat down and like analyzed the lyrics of it.
Yeah.
To be fair. And also I had this really weird thing when I was a kid where I really couldn't understand lyrics for some reason.
Mm.
And we'll get into that. There's a song specifically where I had no idea what the hell Mike Shinoda was saying. Yeah. I wasn't too big in on the lyrics. Yeah. Once again, I think it's just a really solid Linkin Park song.
But then we come to, and I guess this is interesting because what I've got here is I've said arguably the most famous song on the album. And I'd say that's undisputed. But when I think about kind of my love of the album, for me, it's One Step Closer. But I think it is In the End that is the most famous song on the album. Like,
In the End is definitely the most famous song on the album.
Yeah.
In the End is the song that got everyone going, who the fuck is this?
Yeah.
It's the song that was playing on every pop radio station in America. It's the song that got everybody to go, who is this new band? I want to listen to their album. Yeah, that's the song that really broke them.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
I mean, Pitchfork say in terms of its recognition, they say the glitch drum shuffle and moody piano that lead it off are as immediately recognizable as the nosebleed thrashing which announces Master of Puppets. Which, you know, again, it is the moment you hear that little piano riff, you know exactly what song's coming on. Obviously you'd said play it all over the radio, this huge song. Why is that? Why has this song resonated with so many people?
I don't know if it really resonated with so many people or was just forced down people's throats. You know, because I know the radios were real famous, or labels were really famous for doing that And I mean, they still do that to this day. Radio's changed a lot, of course, but that song just has, it has everything you really need to make a really like poppy, influential kind of song. You know, it's got Chester's like clean vocals in the verses. It's got this really like melancholy piano going, and but it's got like a steady groove throughout the whole thing. And then of course the hook is massive. They have a massive hook on this song. And so it's definitely one of the greatest hooks written of all time. And everything from the start to the finish of the song is basically just one giant hook.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, Mike allegedly spent 24 hours alone in the rehearsal space writing this song and getting it how he wanted it. In spite of that, Chester actually, and I think sometimes this is the case when you're so close to something, but Chester wasn't convinced by the song. And he told V Music, he said, "I was never a fan of it in the end. I didn't even want it to be on the record. How wrong could I have possibly been? I basically decided at that point, I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about, so I leave that to other people who are actually talented in somehow picking songs that people are going to like the most. It also gave me a good lesson as an artist that I don't necessarily have to only make music that I want to listen to. More often than not, something that I like, very few other people like. And something that those people like is something that I kind of like or don't like at all." Do you find that from your own process? Is it difficult sometimes to separate yourself from the music and think to yourself, you know, obviously there Chester was like, oh, I don't even want it on the record, but it was this hugely iconic song. Is it difficult sometimes to be able to spot that and to be able to kind of separate yourself from the music you've created?
Totally. It totally is. And I get where he's coming from. Like, you know, like you hear a song for the first time at face value, you're like, okay. And then you hear it again, you're like, okay. Mm-hmm. And I feel like him, he thought it was probably just too poppy. I feel like that's where he probably came from on it. Like where he's like, I want to be aggressive. I want to be angry. And this song is just, it's sad. It's a sad song.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was maybe like it was just too much. Like it was like too melancholy, too smooth, I guess I would say. There was no aggression in it. But yeah, as far as like being an artist goes, like having the like knowledge to be able to like go, oh, this song's going to be good for us, this song's going to be bad for us, it's definitely really, really hard. Yeah, I just do what Chester does, and who knows, I could be terribly wrong one day. And you know, I would love that. But yeah, I listen to a song and I go, nah, I don't, this doesn't fit our album. This doesn't fit our vibe. This is not the play. But you know, I could be wrong, and I have been wrong before. So, you know, I've been wrong about artists that I thought were going to go nowhere, and then, you know, out of nowhere they blow up, and I'm like, okay, I don't understand the music industry anymore. I don't understand the music world anymore. So,
yeah, I mean, how crazy is it to think? And I know we've said obviously this was a single that was played over and over again. Again, the music video was on constantly as well on MTV and stuff. How crazy is it to think there's a possibility that in the end never made it onto this album? Like if Chester had his way, would this album be a lesser album without In the End?
Yes. Yeah. 100% would. Yeah. Because like I said, In the End introduced millions of kids to Linkin Park. And without In the End, like Linkin Park would still be a band, but Hybrid Theory wouldn't be the album that it was.
Yeah.
People wouldn't have discovered Crawling, you know? Is Crawling even a single?
It was in the UK. I don't know about America, but definitely in the UK.
I just don't remember.
Yeah. I mean, we talked earlier about kind of sort of people's attitudes and in society and stuff changing around the time Hybrid Theory came out. Now, In the End was the fourth single released from the album in the autumn of 2001. I think from when I looked, it was about 3 or 4 weeks after 9/11. And so obviously we know 9/11 changed our world forever. You know, we're talking about this kind of mood of uncertainty and anxiety that we've had for the last 20 years, a huge part of it kind of happening that day. I mean, how much of that do you think is time? And I don't mean that in a cynical way with kind of the record companies and stuff, but how much do you think that, you know, we've had this huge world event that was devastating and tragic and we're still feeling the ramifications of, and then along comes a song like this that just seemed to really resonate with people?
It's probably pretty important, to be honest. You know, all right, 9/11 didn't affect me at all as a kid. I didn't give a shit. You know, the people that did and the people that like felt like this is like America's like falling. Yeah. I feel like that was definitely a very important song for them. And of course the labels are like, let's get money.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in the end, like I say, it has, it's transcended what is already a great album. You know, just to run some bits off here, VH1 called it the 84th greatest song of the noughties. Kerrang named it their best rock song in their Rock 100 list in 2015. Loudwire ranked it number 2 on the top 21st century hard rock songs. So we've talked about how much it was played on radio, how much the record companies maybe had a role in it becoming such a success. You know, why do you think, because obviously with the songs like that, you know, if we think, I don't know, Gangnam Style a few years ago, you know, that was a huge hit, but that's not still resonating with us. That still doesn't have an impact. Why do you think this song continues to have the impact that it does?
I think because it was forced down our throats.
Yeah.
I'm gonna be so honest. Yeah. It's like, as far as like albums go, like as songs go on this album, I will skip in the end.
Okay.
Because I've heard this song so many times in my life and I'm just like, yeah, I get it. Like, I've heard this song like more times than I've heard anything in my life, and so I'm just like, I'm just gonna skip this one. Like, I'm kind of sick of it.
Yeah. Well, let's move to one that's probably not played anywhere near as much, which is A Place for My Head. So Kerrang say this one. It's punky opening guitar and pounding percussion, bouncing like a basketball down the stairs, transcends into a fiery mic verse with one of Hybrid Theory's most recognizable guitar lines. I mean, what are your thoughts on A Place for My Head as we're kind of continuing that journey through the album?
I think it's the second best song in the album. I think it's so good. And also Mike's rapping is just so on point and like focused. And it's just so good. I love this song. That guitar riff gets me hyped.
And I guess that's really interesting because I one of my favorite parts of, because I really like this song too, one of my favorite parts of the whole album, which I'm sure you know which bit it is on this track. But We Plug Good Music, they have some kind of gentle criticism for this one. They'd said, A Place for My Head, if I'm being honest, it's my least favorite track. It feels similar to Runaway, and after the previous track, feels unremarkable. Do you think for some, and if we're talking about sequencing, do you think that, you know, we've had In the End, which for a lot of people is this really huge track, do you think that maybe A Place for My Head kind of suffers from following that? It certainly doesn't for you by the sounds of things.
No, yeah, I think it does, though, because it's also like, A Place for My Head is so... it's like the most experimental song, I would argue, on the album. I think my two favorite songs are the most experimental songs on the album. So A Place, Points of Authority and A Place for My Head. And they're so different and so weird. That guitar riff is very different. It's very weird. It's a clean guitar too. And so it's just like, yeah, I think it's just an experimental song. And like, it's very artistic. And I guess I've always really appreciated that.
I think what I love about it is there's that real, like I say, that clean guitar, that almost kind of experimental kind of thing. And then it builds up to what I think is one of the most memorable moments up there with Shut Up When I'm Talking to You, is that scream, that screaming of, you try to take the best of me, go away.
Yeah, that part's, it's so good. The whole song's so good. And like that, the breakdown, like that's a breakdown.
Yeah.
I loved that song. I still love that song. I will, like, when that song comes on, I make it a point to never skip that song. Like, that song is just so good. Like, I don't even know, maybe it's my number one song on the album.
Yeah, it's between that and Points of Authority.
Yes. Yeah, those are my two favorite songs on the album.
Yeah,
without a doubt.
Let's go on to Forgotten. So there's some more love from Kerrang for Forgotten. Let's say it might be the perfect showcase of the vocal duo's partnership, obviously talking about Mike and Chester bouncing off each other like they've been doing it for decades, trading line for line, going harder and urging each other on every time. You know, is Forgotten a good example of that kind of unforgettable partnership that these two had, that they could just bounce off each other in the way that they did?
But yeah, no, that's another definite banger of the album. Another genuine Linkin Park song, you know, or Hybrid Theory style song.
I mean, Johan told Kerrang, he said, with this song in particular, we were in the pursuit of matching the hip-hop side of what we were doing with this heavy build-up. It worked perfectly with two vocalists, Chester and Mike, because it created a template for them to really play off each other. And, you know, we've talked a lot about Mike and the hip-hop influence and all of that. And, you know, it's really genuine, and it comes from a kind of a love of hip-hop. Obviously, we know how much Linkin Park have been embraced by kind of rock and metal fans over the years. You know, are they a band who are kind of embraced by kind of the hip-hop community, do you think?
Oh, totally. They got a Jay-Z co-sign. Like,
yeah.
Linkin Park is one of those bands where, like, you don't have to be a fan of rock to like Linkin Park. Like, everybody can like Linkin Park. Linkin Park is one of the most accessible bands that have ever existed. They're one of the most accessible musicians that have ever existed. because both sides of the scope can come in and be like, yeah, this band is tight. Like, this band is cool. Like, I really fuck with this band. So everybody from hip hop to pop to country, like, anybody can listen to Linkin Park and be like, this is a great band.
So as we head towards the end of the album, so one of my favorite moments of the album, and I think it really kind of, it comes at a really good, a cool time as well, is Cure for the Itch, which is a showcase for Mr. Hahn himself, Joe Hahn. I always remember that kind of, that intro at the beginning was like, I'd like to introduce Mr. Hahn, and then this kind of crazy DJ little bit that he has going on. And we've talked so much particularly about Chester and Mike, and we've touched on Joe a little bit. How important would you say he is to the Linkin Park sound?
I'd say like he's definitely a crucial part. You know, like there's definitely like all these songs, like could they breathe and live without him? Yeah, they could. But you know, what he adds is texture to the songs. He adds something that, you know, nobody else really has. You know, he was doing something in rock music that no one else was really doing. Is he a crucial part? I wouldn't say he's a crucial part, but he's definitely a very, it's definitely very artistic. It's very appropriate. And like, it makes sense with their music.
I mean, what are your thoughts in terms of its placement on the album? So it's the second last track on the album that we have this almost kind of interlude, I guess. I feel like it comes in at a great time. Like if you were to tell someone that that's what you were going to do, that feels like an odd choice, but it, for me, it feels like a really, really, a really great place to have this on the album. What do you think?
I mean, like, as far as like, how long is Cure for It?
I think it's maybe a couple of minutes.
Yeah, it's like 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes.
Yeah.
I don't know. I would probably put that towards the middle of the album.
Hmm.
Honestly, like, you know, just kind of get it in there. It's so challenging though. Like when you're like playlisting an album, like, you don't want any songs to be missed. So, but you put the lesser songs that you're like, okay, someone's not going to make it here.
Mm-hmm.
Like songs that you think less of at the bottom. But I don't know. I think it could definitely benefit from going in the middle. Like, I think it would actually be better for the entirety of the album if it was more towards the middle.
I mean, Kerrang are obviously very careful in their ranking to say that they thought this was an album without a bad track in it, but they did place Cure the Itch last in their ranking of the songs. They said, we're sorry, Joe, but this list has to start somewhere. I mean, what do you think about that? I know it is more of kind of like an interlude of sorts. You know, I don't want to use the word worst, but is it the least good part of the album, would you say?
Yeah, I think I would say so. It's just relatively boring in the grand scope of the album, even compared to Runaway, which I think is not a very good song on the album. It's the same thing with Meteora, where they had that like the flute thing, like, and I was just like, okay, I'm just gonna skip this, like, shut up. But like, I don't know, I don't consider it like a totally real song by any means. I mean, of course it's a real song, but like, it's one of those songs that it doesn't have that song could not be on the album and it would still be an amazing album.
So let's move on to our final track, which is Pushing Me Away. On his Twitch stream in 2020, Mike said of the song, I don't remember how that song came together in terms of pieces. I know that we made it in the studio while we were making the album, and we wanted another song in the vibe of Crawling. I think Don was pushing that, and he was looking to see if we could beat Crawling. That was a high bar. At that point, we didn't know Crawling would be Crawling. It was just a song by Linkin Park that we'd written. So it was like, can we do a song better than this one? Let's try it. I mean, what do you think of that comparison? Do you feel that there are kind of similarities between the two? And do you feel Crawling's the better song than Pushing Me Away?
Yeah, there's definitely similarities between the two. Like from like very, this one has like, I feel like they did more like spacey synths on Pushing Me Away compared to Crawling. Although Crawling synth is pretty spacey.
Yeah.
But I mean, just like down to the verse of like that, like pretty much like very dynamic dropout kind of style verse. And then into, of course, a big style chorus. Yeah. Like they were definitely trying to copy Crawling.
I mean, Mike and the band, they've gone on record saying that they feel Pushing Me Away is a precursor of sorts to Numb. And obviously we just talked about Meteora and Numb would appear.
Yeah,
on
I can actually, yeah, I can hear that.
Yeah. I mean, Mike said, I think without this song, we wouldn't have written Numb. We needed to beat that song. We need a song that's like that song, but better than that song. I mean, can you, obviously you, when I said that, you were instantly like, oh yeah, I can hear that. What is it in Pushing Me Away that you can hear that kind of evolves into Numb on the next album?
It's literally the synths.
Mm.
It's straight up the synths. Those like the synth styles that they were doing and pushing me away, I feel like really influenced the synth style for Numb. So yeah, I feel like, and that's how they like pretty much probably came up with the whole instrumental of Numb.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of it being the end of the album, you know, how does Pushing Me Away end the album for you? Kind of where are you at when you get to the end of the album?
I think it's a good place to end, honestly. I think it's a proper ender, like a proper closer. Like, I don't listen to that song and I'm like, oh, that was disappointing. No, I listen to that song and I'm like, that was fucking awesome.
Yeah.
So I think it's a good closer. I like definitely close strong, right?
Yeah, totally. So Hybrid Theory and indeed Linkin Park themselves, they transcended that new metal scene at the time. The album stands as one of the true classic albums of the new millennium, as we'd said, one of the best selling of the last 20 years. And it's only grown in its resonance and significance with Chester's passing in 2017. And I just want to read the end of an article that Dig wrote that sums up the album's impact. So they say Chester Bennington took his own life in the summer of 2017. His legacy, however, lives on. Most new metal bands at the time sang of general teenage angst and the opposite sex, whereas Bennington left himself open, helping listeners to embrace their own flaws and insecurities. It's a message that set Linkin Park apart from the likes of Papa Roach and Limp Bizkit. That record means a lot, Bennington said of Hybrid Theory. It's allowed us to really know that we can stay true to who we are, we can fight for what we want, and we can take chances we want to take. In fighting for what they believed in, Linkin Park created a 21st century classic. 2 decades on from its original release, Hybrid Theory remains one of the most inspirational debut albums of all time. With that in mind, why has Hybrid Theory stood the test of time, would you say?
Because, you know, nearly every single song on that album, they try to make an absolute banger. Every song is a single. It genuinely could be, even Runaway. Every song on that album is just so impactful and so important that, like, that's what makes it one of the best albums of all time. Is because, you know, it's not, they didn't just release us, like, in the end and then give us a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like a lot of artists have done, you know, even Appetite of Destruction. I listened to some songs on that album. I'm just like, yo, what the fuck are they doing here? But that album, like front to back, it's genuinely like perfect. Like you can listen to every single song and enjoy every single moment of every single song.
And finally, why is Hybrid Theory your classic album? And why should the few people that haven't checked it out, check it out if they haven't already?
I don't think there's anybody listening to it. Or I don't think there's anybody in the world that doesn't know who Linkin Park is.
Yeah.
Like my dad lives under a rock and he's like, oh yeah, so you like Linkin Park? And I was like, yeah. You know, like everybody knows who Linkin Park is. But it's just one of those albums where it's like it has stood the test of time too. Because even to this day, it still sounds fresh.
Mm-hmm.
Which is insane. It's just a really good album front to back, and there's no disappointment in the entirety of the album.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining me. As I'd said at the top, like one of my favorite albums of all time. I'm really pleased we've finally had the chance to do it. I mean, obviously in terms of Fame on Fire and all of that kind of stuff, I know obviously after you finish speaking to me, you'll be heading to the studio. What are your plans for the band over the coming months?
Over the coming months, we are currently working on, we're going to studio to do some TikToks and stuff like that, you know,
yeah.
Keep up with the content. But, you know, we got a tour with Star Set. Our single Plastic Heart is out now. And, you know, you can go on YouTube, check out the video. And, yeah, we're just getting ready for tour and get ready to release some more singles because there might be an album coming soon.
Huge thanks to Brian Kuznets from Fame on Fire for taking the time out to chat with me all about Linkin Park's Hybrid Theory. I always really appreciate, you know, I know how busy these guys all are, and yet they love to come on the show and chat about the music that inspired them. And it means a lot that people take an hour or 2 hours out of their very busy schedules just to chat shit with me, basically. It's a lot of fun. So thanks to Brian for joining me. As I said earlier on there when I was playing Plastic Heart, their new album, Welcome to the Chaos, is out on the 22nd of July. So, you know, make sure that you're picking that up, you know, wherever you can. You know, from what I've heard of it so far, it is a fantastic album. So absolutely check it out. But from one of my favorite bands of my formative years to a classic band that I fell in love with around the same time, we're finally going to be diving in to a Motorhead album in a couple of weeks' time. So that's all we've got time for today. But in a couple of weeks, we'll be looking at Motorhead's, in some ways, kind of a comeback album, I would say. And that'll make sense when you tune in. But yeah, we're going to be looking at Motorhead's Orgasmatron, joined by Tim Atkinson from Leader of Down, who has a lot of love and a lot of cool interactions and experiences with Motorhead. So you don't want to miss this one. Great episode for any Motorhead fans. Make sure that you tune in. You don't want to miss it. I'll see you in a couple of weeks. Cheers.